The Loose Cannons podcast is a free-form discussion about film that contains mature language,
such as poop and titty,
and descriptions of mature situations,
such as filing taxes and raising children.
We do not have any concern for spoilers, so if you haven't seen the film or films we are discussing and don't want to have the twists ruined for you, please watch the film before listening to the podcast.
Sai che mi ha portato mio zio dall'America?
Cosa?
Hey everyone, another Loose Cannons podcast coming at you. Today we're going to be discussing 1970s The Conformist, directed by Bernardo Bertolucci. As always, you can find any of our podcasts and otherwise content on loosecannons.net. I assume you know how to spell it since you booked up the podcast, but just in case you've forgotten between now and then, L-O-O-S-E-C-A-N-O-N-S.
Just
two
one
N's, not... Yeah? Just, yeah. Two total N's, not three. We don't shoot our looseness at people. We revere it, biblically.
Yeah, we curate it.
We've got one video up, more soon, and of course lots of writings, mostly from Basil, who is a really good writer. You should check them out, and you should discuss them on the website. All right, moving on. Heralds and denouncements. I guess, Michael, you can kick us off. You like, is there a movie that you saw besides The Conformist that you either really liked or really disliked that you want to herald or denounce?
Yeah, I saw The Hunt from, I think it was 2012.
Mm-hmm.
That was really good. Has Mads Mikkelsen, who is always awesome. Should I give a plot description or?
You could just say like briefly why you liked it.
Oh yeah, all the performances are really good, and I thought for the subject matter, it actually handled it, you know, in a fairly subtle way compared to, you know, the way it's usually handled. It's about a guy who's accused of basically being a child molester, and he lives in a small town, and the fallout from the accusation. Really good, lots of good performances. Yeah. Thumbs up.
Love Mads Mikkelsen. By the way, did you say that Michael was joining us today, Ruben?
Oh, yeah.
For the uninitiated.
Week two and the guest month podcast, month host guest podcast. Dr. Jameson was last week. Joining us this week is Michael, who you just heard.
Mm.
And we'll be having more guest hosts in the guest month host podcast guest coming up.
Oh, yeah.
And Michael's replacing Patrick. So you'll hear me and Ilya and Basil and Michael and no Patrick, who is on vacation or just got back from vacation.
In Houston.
Hi, Patrick.
He saw some bats and some space. Space bats.
Nice.
Basil, do you have anything you'd like to herald or denounce?
Yeah, I'll go ahead and denounce Harold and Maude, which I hadn't seen since I was a kid. And
it sounded like you were confused about whether you wanted to denounce or herald.
Oh. Not in this case. I mean, I could pick some good movies that I saw, but I'd rather talk about one that I didn't like.
No, because Harold.
What?
I'd like to denounce Harold and Maude.
Oh, I get you.
I only got that now.
Slow on the uptake this morning. Yeah. Harold and Maude is a not very good movie, I think. I saw it when I was a kid and I really liked it. and my mom really liked it, and now rewatching it for this class that I'm taking on the 60s, it seems really bad. I don't know. The Maude character is very didactic. Like, you can tell that she's just a cipher for how the writer feels like people should be living. So every single thing she says is like, ooh, go out and seize the day and live life and enjoy it and don't be burdened by social pressures. And I don't know. It's not very funny and really self-satisfied with its own ethos. Like, super obviously believes this is the best way people should be living, and I'm going to teach you how to do that. And it's really annoying. And I didn't find any of the, like, fake suicide humor funny at all. I found it really gross. So, not a good movie.
Mm. Yeah, I only heard about, I only knew about that movie because I knew that Ruben hated it. That's the only, like...
I sure don't like that movie.
It's pretty famous in America for being very well liked by people in their early 20s. And also old people who are alive when it came out.
Right. I'd like to herald Cabin in the Woods, which I rewatched just the other day, and it's still probably one of my favorite movies of the last couple years. Really, really great in both, like, the way it comments on genre tropes, but also kind of creates characters that act in a way that is not, like, wholly predictable, and plays with that whole thing really well of how, like, you know, how basically gross our desire to manipulate characters can be and is, and how that is mostly the thrill of that you get out of watching horror. And I don't know, I really, really liked it, and the ending just is really so, still so great. Like, I still remember when the first time I watched it, how, like, amazed I was that they just unleashed every single monster that they could think of into that lab. Like, it's, watching it just still really makes me happy just to see how much work they put into that. So, yeah.
I'm super excited for Joss Whedon to be done with the Avengers, which he has now, so that he can get back to doing.
He's done now, totally?
I assume he's going to keep doing Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., but...
Okay.
But he's done... Okay. And he said he might do some, like, I don't know, script doctoring or whatever, but he's for sure done with directing the movies.
Thank God.
Yeah. So now he can go back to writing In Your Eyes, too.
Technically the highest-ranked movie of his that I've seen. I'm going to denounce Kingsman, the new Matthew Vaughn film. I was surprised that I was really close to, like, feeling indifferent towards it until the end, and then it basically went in the exact same direction as Kick-Ass, where it sort of wants to have its cake and eat it too. Like, it wants you to feel for the characters, but also be a satire at the same time. And so it ends up just being gross because you're supposed to like these characters, and then they're doing gross things because that's the satirical part, I guess.
Right.
But it never lands at the right tone. If it had wanted to be satirical, it should have made us dislike the main two characters more. And if it wanted to be serious, it shouldn't have done the really gross stuff that it does at the end. I guess I'll sort of spoil one thing, which is just to say that there's a part where, like, a couple thousand people die, and you're like, it's really obviously played for laughs. because they're bad people. And I was like, this is deeply unpleasant to watch in a movie in which we're supposed to care about, in which we think the main character who's kind of initiated all those people dying is a good person. Mm. So
people dying is funny, though.
It's true.
Hard to argue with that.
Moving on, we're going to be discussing The Conformist, as I already mentioned, and as this was Michael's pick, he's going to give us a short plot description, and then Basil, Ilya, and I will say what we thought of it, and then Michael, and then we'll move into the free discussion as per usual.
Okay, so the movie is The Conformist. It's about a young man, Marcello, the titular conformist, who I guess is joining the fascist party in Italy in the 1930s. And as part of joining the, I guess it's the fascist secret police, he's required to sort of go on a mission to France to assassinate an exiled or a refugee, I guess, a university professor who is engaged in anti-fascist activities from France. And the story is sort of told, I guess, through a series of, I don't know if you'd call them flashbacks or just vignettes, and that sort of build up a profile of the main character over the course of the movie, leading up to, you know, sort of the final events of the movie. That's about it, I think, right?
Yeah, pretty good.
Solid. I really like this movie a lot. I think it's one of the most, like, beautifully shot movies that I've seen. There are a bunch of shots where I was just like, wow, I'm amazed that I'm looking at this right now. And I thought that the sort of play with chronology was pretty interesting every time. And yeah, I mean, just the whole idea of this, like, hyper-aestheticized thing as a way of grappling with fascism, which was all about hyper-aestheticization, is kind of an interesting thing to do in the 1970s. And I feel like, for me at least, Bertolucci pulled it off, so I liked it a lot.
Yeah, I liked it too. I like the fact that Bertolucci didn't really try to, like, the way the movie was sort of interested in psychology, but not, didn't try to, like, over psychoanalyze its characters, like, not dig too deeply, but more like stayed pretty surface level, but made the characters more interesting in that way. I thought it was great. I thought it was visually just amazing. I actually, like, much of, I've read that this movie, like, directly inspired Coppola and stuff, but actually the person I was most thinking about while watching it was Verhoeven. Mm-hmm. Because not only because of this mixture of, like, fascism as a theme, like, hyper aesthetics, really fluid camera movement, and eroticism, like, all, right, like, that mixture of all of that together really reminded me of him, and I think he was pretty influenced by this. I was not expecting to really like this as much, because the only other Bertolucci movie I watched was Last Tango in Paris, and I really didn't like that one the last time I watched it. But this was really good.
I like this movie. I think maybe if I rewatched it, I could really like or love it. Personally, I got kind of lost in the plot, and about halfway through, I checked the Wikipedia page to, like, and there were some details that I definitely missed and stuff like that, and I'm not sure that the framing device really worked for me. I didn't understand exactly why you couldn't just put it in the order that it happened, as opposed to, like, the flashbacks in the car and stuff, but I agree with everyone else that it was really beautifully shot, and, yeah, that's pretty much what most of my notes are. It obviously reminded me of other Italian directors like Antonioni and Bert Mueller. And I should probably watch more Italian films, because I like how they use shape so much.
Mm. Michael?
Oh, me now? Okay, sorry.
It's all good.
Yeah, I liked it too. Maybe a little bit less than you guys, but I still thought it was a pretty good movie. Visually, obviously, it was really great. The use of colors I liked a lot in some of the scenes. The plot was... I think I agree with Ruben. I wasn't crazy about the way it kind of jumped back and forth. The plot was a little bit, I think, overly confused in that way, but overall it was pretty good. I don't think I got some of maybe the symbolism that he was going for with some of the scenes, though. So maybe part of it was lost on me in that way. But overall, it was pretty good.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I missed out a lot on a lot of symbolism here, too. But I think it still worked for me just because, like, the aesthetics were, I don't know, like, the framing was made and done in such a way that it, like, it felt to me like this had something going on there that was really interesting and that I would be interesting to find out more about. This movie seems like really dense with like stuff that Bertolucci was trying to like put in there, like from references to like paintings all the way to obviously like other filmmakers and stuff. Like it seems like he was trying to like really maybe show off a little bit, but mostly really like comment on how he thinks about art. And like every scene was loaded with that to some degree.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Nice long pause.
Sorry, what'd you say?
I said nice long pause.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, let's think for a bit.
This is a Thinking Man's podcast. What were you saying, Basil?
Oh, I was just gonna say that. I mean, I guess it's pretty obvious, but the whole idea of being super concerned with being normal and the character, other characters totally referencing normality and like being normal all the time, and then like when he's confessing that story that happened to him with the limo driver, and the character's like, have you had any other homosexual experiences? And he's like, no, they've all been normal. And just this like obvious really concern that trying to be like a normal person. And so that I mean, obviously with the way the movie ends, it comes around that now that fascism's not in favor, being normal is being anti-fascist, so he quickly denounces being fascist.
Yeah. And he's also at that point kind of further enticed by, I think, a homosexual encounter potentially at that point, isn't he?
Yeah, I mean, when he re-encounters the limo driver and then like quickly denounces him and obviously accuses him of the murder that he feels responsible for, I feel like actually I was gonna rate this movie even higher, but I thought that part was a little on the nose and it made me drop my rating very slightly, although I still rated it very high.
I was thinking because the boy that the limo driver had been talking to, the boy or the man I should say, was still there, and he was kind of lying on that bed naked playing that sort of romantic music. It was kind of him being enticed back into possibly another homosexual encounter or something like that. But yeah, point taken though, Basil.
I mean, at the beginning of the movie, when he's in the like hotel room or bedroom with that person, because they're like lying down and all you see is their butt, it's like not super clear whether or not it's a man or a woman, which I thought was kind of cool foreshadowing of that. It's like, I don't know, something about the way that was shot with, like, the red light on him and something. I was like, oh, he likes men, doesn't he? I don't know. I just thought that almost immediately when the movie started.
Yeah.
That's pretty interesting. I didn't even catch that. I wrote that down because I was wondering if that was where this shot originated, because I feel like it's super popular now to have like a spy person wake up next to a naked woman. But if it's gender ambiguous, that makes it even more interesting.
Yeah, it's a pretty funny reference to The Samurai by Melville.
Oh.
And like I felt like it was funny because like he takes the fedora, right, and like touches the brim.
Oh, sure.
Like, straightens the brim. And but like the fedora was laying on that person's butt, like it's just really kind of gross.
I'm pretty sure that person was a woman. I just think that it was.
Yeah, yeah,
like,
I'm pretty
you
sure.
Never get to see them roll over.
It was his wife.
Anything.
Yeah,
I think it was his wife.
That's important.
Oh, it was.
Well, yeah, fiance because at that point, I guess.
No, they would have been married by then because it's them in Paris, right? And they're on their honeymoon.
Yeah,
go to Paris.
Oh, is that? Oh, yeah, because there's French on the sign that he's looking at.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's the same room that they go to stay in later when they arrive in Paris later in the movie.
Okay.
The bed is the same. It's the same bed.
By the end of the movie, the beginning seemed like 2 months ago or something. It was so.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like so much stuff happens in this movie. It's really tough to like keep up.
Yeah, did you end up watching it twice, Michael? I know you mentioned to me off.
Yeah, podcast. I did. I watched it like 2.5 times because I fell asleep halfway through one time.
Nice.
So I watched it all the way through twice and then that other half.
Showing us our proper podcast preparedness.
I'll probably wait a little bit longer before I rewatch it. But it's definitely getting added to the rewatch list because I felt like I could get more out of it than I did.
It makes a lot more sense, even just from a plot standpoint, the second time around.
I definitely like getting back to sort of what, not about the ending, but just sort of what Basil was saying. I did feel like some things were kind of like on the nose in a way that it didn't feel like they were so on the nose that they were funny, but just sort of like them stating a certain opinion, like when they were talking about his mom's valet, who was also like her sexual, I don't know, side piece.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, his name is Trees. That's a weird name. Something about being like, oh yeah, fascism doesn't allow for anything that's not exactly what you would expect. I don't know. There was like little moments like that where people would just say out loud what was going on.
Right.
His name was Trees?
Well, his name is Key. And
yeah.
Apparently that means trees, and I think he was Japanese.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, because yeah. I don't know if we had the same.
Maybe the one different translation, I think, but yeah, that's cool.
Yeah.
Well, they keep calling him Trees. They call him like Labarita or something like that, which is definitely. Uh-huh. Trees in
okay.
Italian, or at least I recognize the word arbor from French.
Mm. Okay.
Mm-hmm. What was
the version
the
I was watching? The version I was watching said his name was Hemlock.
Hemlock. Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which I guess would be like, because he's supplying her with poison, I suppose.
Yeah. That's that's even more on the nose, but there in a different way.
Yeah.
But they're definitely saying like forest or trees in the. I obviously I don't know Italian, but I know a little French, and I definitely mm-hmm. heard like arborite or something like that. So,
yeah. But
it could be. I would agree with you.
I would agree with you that it's definitely on the nose, and when it does start spelling things out, which is why I'm really glad that mostly it doesn't try to like do a lot of analysis. Like, it's really, like, I think I read, like, in Jonathan Rosenbaum, like, complaining about this movie that was like, okay, yeah, it didn't really have anything to say. Like, it was really pretty, but it didn't have, like, any kind of interesting take on whatever it was doing. And, like, this movie does not try to, like, track the source of or the analyze the roots of why people become fascist. It's more interested in, like, okay, so how does a person who's like so used to lying to himself and like just can't admit certain things, certain parts about himself, behave in a society that is basically also constructed to reward people like that. Mm. Like that you shouldn't. Yeah, it's not about what you who you really are. It's about how well you can pretend that you're something you're not. And like the way it kind of showed him pretending was really cool. Like I was always very convinced that like he was about to like crack at any moment, and just the way he like just bounced around in this movie from like acting like he was really knew what he was doing, and like he was he could convince people around him that he was who he said he was, and the moments where he's just completely breaking apart and was basically admitting how much of a fraud he is. Like, the tension between that I really, really liked. And so, I don't know, like, even though it is really obvious at times, it was, like, to me, when it was not trying to say something, but just kind of reveled in its aesthetics, that was when it was, like, the best, at its best.
I really liked his blind friend's description of what a normal man was. It's like, a normal man is someone who looks at a lady's bottom, and there are other men also looking at her bottom. This is why a normal man likes to go to bars and to sports games, and so that he could be surrounded by other men looking at ladies' bottoms. And he is a fascist. It's like, oh, if you look at women's bottoms, you are a fascist.
True fascist.
Yeah.
Yeah, sort of going by what Ilya said, I was like, oh, in a way, this movie is about how fascism tries to tell you to be in love with your own repression. Just, like, push all that stuff down and feel real good about it. It's going to be happy.
If you're unhappy, that's the sign you're on the right path.
But he definitely did fall in love with the professor's wife, right? Or is that just more weirdness?
Yeah, I think he did. I think she just, like, had to, like, play along to try to save her husband and herself. That's how I read it, at least.
Yeah, that was how I read it, too. That she, unlike everyone else, is, like, super hip to what's happening and not fooled by him at all, and that might be part of the reason why he sort of falls in love with her, that, you know, that she, like, even though he's constantly pretending, she still sees him for what he is, and that's, like, super rare in his life, obviously, and but because of that, she can never love him back because he's a gross person who's trying to kill her husband.
Yeah, she even calls him a worm, right?
Yeah.
Just a worm.
Yeah, that is Anna, right? Anna is just the wife of the professor. Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's also, like, pretty much the total opposite of his fiance or his wife.
Julia.
She's still his fiance at that point. Julia. Not just...
No, she's his wife at that point. As soon as they go to Paris, she's his wife.
Yeah.
That's their honeymoon.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Obviously, once they're on the... Yeah.
I was just going to say, once they're on the train, they've been married at that point.
Right.
I think.
So
that's why they do it.
Blonde brunette thing is the obvious
Verhoeven
thing
connection.
Here. That's, yeah, for me also, yeah, Hitchcock and Verhoeven connection. But mostly Verhoeven for me, because that's, like, the thing that he really loves to do. Also, like, she is just in many ways, like, just as a character, completely different. Like, she tells him exactly what she thinks of him. She kind of, like, she's not submissive. And she only acts submissive because she's doing it to help her husband. Like, that scene where she kind of offers herself up to him, I felt like that, like, this movie has, like, really, whatever, like, really weird relationship with sex, because, like, whenever sex is happening, it's shown in this really, like, I don't know, all the, like, the movie looks really pretty, so, like, I was kind of expecting the sex scenes to, I guess, also be, but they're kind of purposely not pretty. They're always kind of off in a way. And, like, the scene where she's, like, covered in this blue light and, like, steps up, walks up to him, she doesn't even look human. Like, mm-hmm. It's kind of supposed to probably make this look like she's kind of giving up her humanity to be with him for, to save herself.
And in the earlier scene, his wife is, like, confessing her earlier sexual encounter, and he is mimicking the things that yes. she said the other guy did to him.
That was amazing, yeah.
Yeah, and it's not even really, like, a sexual encounter. It's more like sexual assault, because it's, like, an old guy, yeah. and she's, like, 15, and it's really yeah. gross. And I was like, this
and
is
he just does
one of the
all
most
those things to her. It's yeah. so weird. Super weird.
Also, yeah. I mean, I forgot to mention it, but when we were talking about the confession thing, I felt like it was a really weird reveal because he's confessing to that priest, and then it cuts back to, like, a wider shot, and his wife is just, like, sitting there, like, 5 feet away from him in her wedding dress. So it's like they got married, and then she just listens to him give his confession to the priest. And I was like, this is an extremely strange situation.
I didn't think she could hear him. Did you?
Yeah. Yeah, it didn't.
I know she was. I know she was sitting very close, but she didn't even like react when he said like she's a bed and kitchen wife or whatever.
Oh, yeah, you're probably right.
Yeah,
she didn't. Yeah, I think they were getting ready to get married at that point because I think they were saying the priest wouldn't marry them until he had done confession.
Oh,
So she was probably just waiting for him to be finished there,
right?
Finish confessing, like.
That makes it even more sad, although that's more in keeping with her character, I guess. She's pretty oblivious throughout.
Do you think Anna's sexual overtures toward Julia were motivated by desire or motivated by wanting to drive Marcello crazy?
Yeah, I think the latter more.
I would have thought the former, maybe. I thought she was just supposed to represent, like, somebody said before, she's kind of the opposite. The professor's wife is kind of the opposite of Marcello, in that she's sort of like a liberated person. She's sexually liberated, I guess. And, you know, being a bisexual or a homosexual or anything like that would be kind of antithetical to sort of the philosophy that he's taken up, the sort of Italian fascist philosophy. So I guess it's both, maybe.
Yeah, I think both is a solid. Mm. That I mean, more that she could definitely be attracted to Julia, but I feel like in pursuing Julia specifically, it's more about making Marcello uncomfortable than it is about like her really having anything that in common with Julia. I feel like.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I strongly believe that it's also to just kind of, because as we talked about before, she seems to really see him for who he is, and she probably recognized there's some weird, like, repressed stuff going on there, and she basically tries to seduce Julia right in front of him, just to rub it right into his face, like, just like how much she can do and is willing to do. And it's like doesn't hide, and how he has to basically. That's weird though, because like she doesn't seem like, I feel like that's always going on under the surface. Like she's not like looking at him like, "Huh, see how I'm like basically trying to have sex with your wife." It's more like she's also acting like she's doing it for him, like because she also keeps wanting to seem attractive to him, and you know who, like apparently in the you know, judging by the hetero stereotype that all men want to see two women make out together, that's like should totally be attractive to him. Like she's almost in a weird way it's like suggested that she's doing it just because he would like to see that, you know.
Although he also hates that he
mind.
I think yeah. the professor really didn't mind, yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say that he likes it, but also seems, like, repulsed by it. And there's the part where he's spying on them when they're dressing that's super uncomfortable, and I thought was pretty cool, and the way that it puts the viewer in his POV before you even know that he's there, like it's shot through the door and we just see like half of it, and then we get the reverse shot where we see that it's actually him, but before that it's just like,
we get the reverse shot where we see that it's just a dark like shadowy space or whatever first, and I was like, that's cool. When the reverse shot happened, I thought it would immediately be his face, and then it was just like, it kind of keeps you even more off your guard. You're like, oh no, there's nobody there, and then it cuts again and it's like a wider shot, and then you see him. I was like, ha. Gotcha. That wasn't the only instance of spying either. The maid was spying on them earlier.
Yeah.
And weren't the maid and him
she made a kissy face at him
having a thing as well?
She mentions it before. He mentions it with.
He mentions it, yeah.
To Italo, I think, because he says, Italo asks about the maid with the big breasts, and Maricello says that she comes with the marriage or whatever, which is a gross thing to say.
She's part of the dowry.
Yeah, he's a pretty gross character. I didn't laugh much at this movie, but I did laugh really hard when he gives the flowers to the maid, and then she pretends like they're for hers for a second, and then Julia's like, those are for me, give them to me, and then she walks over to Julia and gives her the flowers, and then she looks at them for like 1 second and then hands them back to the maid, and it's like, go put these in water. It's like, why did you have a walk over and hand them to you, and then she hands them right back.
Yeah, I thought that was I also thought that was super funny, and like a pretty pointed comment on the weird structure of like a high bourgeois society where you have your, there's a scene in Stella Dallas that's very similar where someone's getting married and they want one of the windows open, and they're standing like 4 feet from the window, and then they tell like a butler to open the windows for them. Like you could just like easily do it yourself. But then she's like, hey, draw those blinds. It's pretty funny. But
Ruben, you didn't laugh at this movie at all? I thought like the first half of the movie was like,
not at all,
totally,
but
a comedy.
Certainly, not a lot.
Okay. I laughed a lot during like the first half of the movie. Just but then the latter half, I think, got a little bit more serious. But I don't know. Like it's almost like two halves, right? Like the fascists are kind of so silly that it's hard not to laugh at them because they just take themselves so seriously, but they look so stupid all the time. But then in the latter half of the movie, like you realize, oh wait, they're actually going to kill this guy still, even though they're like kind of comical. Like, there were a couple, like, when he gets his gun, and he's posing, and he looks like he doesn't even know how to handle it, like, he's posing like he thinks he's supposed to, and then he realizes that he's lost his hat. I don't know, I laughed really hard at that.
Yeah. That was a scene in the, in this weird, brothel, right? Like, it was...
Yeah.
I think it was like that was a brothel, because he walks in there and then his weird fascist sidekick, what's his name? Manganiello. he's in there with this red-headed woman, with this prostitute. Mm-hmm. And after that, he goes sees this Carlos guy who has a desk that's filled with walnuts for some reason.
Yeah. And is he cracking them, like, with the butt of the gun, or is he...
Something, yeah, I'm not 100% sure. It's implied that all fascists have, like, a weird tick.
Is this the part when he goes into the, like, enormous room with, like, the older guy, and he leads him to, like, the desk that's, like, really far away?
No, earlier that's in the movie.
Oh. That's another weird desk.
That part's pretty funny.
Yeah, I feel like... The crazy thing is that the movie's style was kind of all over the place. Like, for a while there, it seemed like it was like tableau-ish, like all these scenes and the where it's just like very like orchestrated, where people are sitting, what kind of colors there are,
and like lots of like things that. Going perpendicular or parallel to the screen.
Yes,
and a lot of very many angles.
Yeah, a lot of cutting on movement too. Like you could feel like this movie was really trying to establish that kind of rhythm. And like sometimes, and then like it would just turn static for a while, where they would just be sitting somewhere, and then people moving in the background and stuff like that. Like it's just, it created like a really fun kind of rhythm to it. I really like that. But I feel like I could really go through like one scene after the next, because like all my notes are just like, oh, that scene looked really great. This other scene looked really great. My favorite probably was actually the just before that scene that we talked about was when he when Marcello drives up to this brothel, I guess, on this carriage, and the camera pans to like a painting, and then the movie cuts from the painting to like an actual like picture. A frame that looks exactly like the painting. Like it was just really awesome. Like that takes like 5 seconds or whatever, but that really, I thought that really looked great.
Mm-hmm. I liked all the puppies when he goes to see his mom. She has a lot of dogs.
She sure does.
Yes. I wrote like down puppies 50. As my first note.
Yeah, he just kind of grabs them, though, and, like, just tosses them away.
He's Aguirre-ing those puppies.
Yeah.
It looks like they're, like, suckling on her or something. Like, it looks really gross.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's a comment on the way that, like, bourgeois people abandon their families or whatever. Because his mom seems really sad and lonely, and then he has that valet at least beaten up, if not killed, and which is like the only human contact she has. It's just like, whatever, mom, doesn't look good, so just hang out in our giant house alone with your puppies.
Yeah.
It's pretty sad. Plus,
I don't get to live out my weird fantasy, so you definitely don't.
Having sex with trees. I guess I did kind of laugh also at the scene where they go to the mental institution together, because it seemed like so like avant-garde in like a goofy way or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like this mental institution, where his dad is. It's like outside in this like marble like amphitheater. And like, I don't know, and they like he said something to him, and he like reaches at him with his like, you know, straight jacket, except that the sleeves are untied at that point, so he's got these like super long sleeves like billowing in the air, and that's like, this seems like it could be in a Bergman film, except for it would be taken seriously,
right? Yeah. I also, speaking of things that I thought were funny, they're constantly referencing the fact that there are counter orders from Rome that people didn't get. So they're like, we did this thing in Africa and we killed all these people, but it was because we didn't get the counter orders that said we weren't supposed to do that. And just this like idea of this weird bureaucracy where people are giving the spies orders and then counter orders, and it's just a big old mess that no one can understand.
Yeah, even the main character, he had orders, I think, to, was it, I think, kill the professor and find his contacts in Italy, but then his counter orders from Rome were just kill him. Don't find the contacts.
And then I felt like maybe this, but probably on purpose, but like, he seems like the worst spy, like, especially like in terms of like sending him to kill someone. He doesn't know how to work a gun, it looks like, at all.
Also, he shows up and everybody knows what he's doing.
Exactly. Like, immediately. And then he takes forever to even, like, get, like, to where he's supposed to. And basically this Manganiello guy has to like chauffeur him around and like make sure that he gets to where he's supposed to go, and like he just complains about him all the time. I thought that was pretty funny, like this just how incompetent he was as a spy. Even though that was like his purpose. Yeah.
He didn't even end up killing either the professor or his wife. Those other guys had to just come and stab him to death in the middle of the forest.
Yeah.
And he doesn't rescue the wife either, which was his secondary mission that he wanted to do.
Apparently, like, someone, like, I don't know, like, asking for help or screaming in pain on one side of the glass compared to someone else is something that just works for me a lot, because I was like, this really hits when it happened with her. And recently I rewatched Catching Fire, and the same thing happens where Katniss gets like trapped in one of the sections, and it's just like Peeta's like screaming to like help her, and he can't reach her. I don't know. Apparently that shot just really works for me.
That whole sequence really worked for me, partly because the camera work had been so tableau-y. I feel like that was the very first time in a movie, maybe ever, that like a handheld following shot when they're chasing her really actually made me super uncomfortable and tense, because so much of the rest of the movie had been so like elaborately framed, this sort of bouncing around camera while they're shooting at her, and you can kind of just barely see her like moving in and out from behind the person's head as she's running away. It's really
scary.
It's
in one of those really weird forests that I only see in European films, but see in European films all the time, where it's like really tall trees that don't have any branches like on their lower section, and they're all over the place. So it's like, it's basically like being in a field, because like you could see everything. There's like no shrubs, there's no like anything except for like these just columns, these like tree columns that are littering the landscape. It's in Ivet's Childhood and Loves of a Blonde too.
Yeah. All European movies are filmed at the same forest. There's just this one forest that everyone goes to. They all film there.
Is it the same one that's filled with St. Bernards? Because that's my dream vacation, is to go to the St. Bernard Forest.
Yeah, no, that scene was, I really liked it too. It was really, I didn't really connect to the movie emotionally a lot, but that part definitely hit home pretty hard for me.
I like when Anna asked if Joya had ever seen her husband laugh.
And then,
I don't think he does laugh.
No, he doesn't. But then he gets really indignant about the idea that he's always serious.
Which like he yells at her. Super serious?
Also, in that scene, I laughed at how terrible Julia was at using chopsticks.
Oh, I didn't even notice.
She's just, like, poking her food.
Oh, yeah.
Like, you never see her eating.
She had, like, one in each hand, I think. And she's trying to, like, get, like, rice with two different hands.
Man, and that restaurant scene, what I thought was really funny, when they went in the back with Manganiello, and then, like, Marcello purposely hits this lamp, right, so it can just keep shaking back and forth, and then they stand in the corner and this lamp just keeps like swinging forever. Like it will never stop swinging. It should have stopped swinging like 5 minutes ago, but it's still swinging because like that's a neat effect. I thought like the movie had a lot of moments where it was like, ah, this looks cool. Why not? Let's try this.
Like, it does.
Yeah, one of the visual things that I wrote down was how much I preferred when they, like, we talked about the red shot at the beginning, and then there's also during the part where Julia's telling about her sexual assault, it's like either a yellow or green light, and I was like, man, I wish directors would still do this instead of doing it in post when it looks so much worse.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Use an actual light, but then, of course, they couldn't, like, decide what they want to do in post. They would have to accept what they did on set.
Yep.
Yeah.
Just fix it in post.
I can't remember who said it, but someone says Rome has become so provincial. Maybe it's the mom because it's my next note after puppies. I feel like this always turns up in Italian films, that there's like this sense that like we were the Roman Empire at one point and now we're so much lower than that than we used to be.
Right.
And this like weird like low self-esteem from or like loss of something that none of these people actually ever had.
There's a like reference. I was going to say there's a reference to that earlier when someone's like two people are moving around a giant iron eagle statue in the middle of the scene when he goes to visit that guy with the really big desk that's super far away. It's just like two people just like transporting.
One guy's carrying the head, right?
Yeah.
That was really funny. That looked really cool. Like my favorite scene probably overall was the scene in the dancing parlor with them, just because I like good dance scenes in movies, and I felt like this was like a lot of fun to watch, and had like really interesting things going on. Like it was really orchestrated really beautifully, the two women, Anna and Julia, start dancing, and then they kind of involve everyone else in this like big like community dance, like everyone's dancing in a big circle, and then they like run out, and you see Marcello sitting there like kind of tapping his hand, which is really funny because it just looks so awkward. Like dancing is like for humans and he's like not really human, so that's pretty I thought that was pretty funny. And then it cuts to him looking at Manganiello, who then starts tapping like he's making fun of him, which I thought was really cool. It's like you can't even tap properly. And then when the people get back in, then he gets like ends up in the middle of all of the crowd. I thought that looked really cool. Like that whole scene, I felt was like, man, people should watch this movie and see how like how you can construct like movement within the scene and how to like organize crowds. You know, like, I thought it was really made really good use of all the people there.
Yeah, I was gonna say there's also a brief shot through the window in that where you can see a picture on the window of Laurel and Hardy, and I was like, oh, that's a good analogy for Marcello and Magnello's relationship.
My favorite shot was already mentioned. It's the one where he's having a conversation with the older guy, I think, about possibly joining the secret police. And the radio show is going on in the background, and he keeps like walking back and forth, and it just keeps panning like to him talking in front of the radio show, to him talking in front of a wall where the women are singing.
I also really like a shot later where Marcello's talking in an office, and there's like sunlight coming in through the window. And light through the door, and then he closes the door, and it's just through the window. I thought that was a really amazing shot.
And he's talking to the professor.
Is that the myth of the cave part, where his shadow disappears?
Yeah.
Yeah.
When he opens the other one. Yeah.
Talking about Plato.
That's Billy's other podcast, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
Talking about Plato.
Not Socrates. Just we're talking about Plato. Just Plato.
Just Plato.
Plato.
I also thought it was interesting that the professor doesn't remember him at all first, and it takes him a really long time to remember him. But then later, the professor's like, "He was one of my best students." Like Marcello's so forgettable as a human that he could be one of his best students and then have to remind him that he was that good. And he's like, oh yeah, you.
I guess he didn't do what I do in school, which is go up to the professor after like half of all the classes and have a conversation with them so they will not forget me.
Nice.
Yeah. And invite him on your podcast.
Yep. Twice.
Yeah.
And I also like the part when Magnello and Marcello talk about how great Switzerland is, because I feel like it, Switzerland would be perfect for Marcello because it's just a neutral country that doesn't commit to anything. He's like, of course you'd be in love with Switzerland. He's like, it's beautiful and you don't have to have any ideology.
He has a dream about Switzerland too, right?
Yeah.
I don't remember that. When was that?
It's later on in the movie. I forget exactly what the details are, to be honest, but he's talking about being in Switzerland and he's going for an operation, I think. And then he gets up and he's like married to Anna, I think. And she takes him away from the operation. I don't know if it's just like a fantasy of his that he's married to her. And I think it's the professor who's operating on him. It's a really weird sequence. It doesn't really go anywhere. He says, I had this really weird dream, and yeah.
Yeah, I think that's the same scene, because then Magnello is like, we used to have a song about Switzerland when I was a kid, and then they sing the weird song about how great Switzerland is.
Good.
I also thought it was funny when they're in Paris and this woman and her two kids start singing the Internationale at them. The song of the international song of communism slash socialism. That was pretty funny. And they just like stalk them all the way to their car. They won't stop singing at them.
That and it's funny. After he's already bought a violet from her.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's your reward for supporting the socialist movement as you get to hear the song.
My last note is when they had the party for him, I guess it was kind of like the equivalent of a bachelor party. It's like he's standing there, they're all standing there in the dark. And then the lights come on, and then they all just, like, walk towards him. It was so weird. Like, it's just, like, him and his blind friend are, like, standing on one side of the room, and then there's, like, 40 people on the other side of the room, and then the lights turn on, and they're, like, happy party, and then they, like, walk towards him, because, like, the food is behind him. It reminded me of a zombie movie.
Was everybody at that party blind? Because there was at least one, a few other people who were blind there.
Like, yeah.
The piano players were all blind, I think.
Yeah.
I didn't even notice that's that.
Me neither.
I think that's all.
There were a lot of people crashing into the buffet.
Yeah. And I think that's also where he decides to stop being friends with Italo, because he looks at him. He's, like, trying to, like, touch him or whatever to see where he is. And then Marcello's kind of like shying away from it. And then when the last thing you see in that scene is Marcello looks really disgusted, and it shows why he's disgusted. It shows that Italo is wearing a brown shoe and a black shoe. It's just like, this guy is not normal. I cannot hang out with him.
His shoes don't conform.
And, that's like, that cool. is the worst possible thing for Marcello. He's just like, people are going to know that this guy is not like everyone else.
You can't tell colors by touch. Okay. Does anyone else have anything they'd like to say about the conformist?
I guess not. I mean, I like the implication later that I think the end of the movie is like after the war, and then or as the war is ending, and then he's still sort of lying to Julia, but there's an implication that she knows what he is and what he did, and that like she's not the same naive person anymore, but he he's still trying to keep their relationship the same as it was. I thought that was a sort of interesting, sad note to be part of the ending.
Michael, tell you?
I don't have anything else to say about the movie, no. Can I give a shout out to Linda, though, for letting me use her computer?
Thanks,
so
that
we can record this podcast. Thank you.
The podcast.
We appreciate all podcast guest hosts, significant others, and the sacrifices they make in order for us to do this.
Yeah, shout out to Betsy for being okay with me talking real loudly at 7 in the morning.
Yes. Shout out to Carla for making me skip dinners together occasionally to do our podcast.
And letting you stay up late sometimes.
Yes. Yes. It's true.
Speaking of people we like, if you enjoy this podcast, you should subscribe to it on iTunes. Give us a nice review. Rate it 5 stars. We appreciate it. Just like we appreciate our significant others. Probably
sure
we appreciate it less than we appreciate our significant others.
Hopefully.
Thanks for listening. And thanks for joining us, of course, Michael. We look forward to every time that you're on the podcast.
Always a pleasure.
Yep. And thanks, Michael.
And thanks for picking a movie that I liked.
Yeah, way to go.
We will leer he sev on you next time on Loose Cannons.
Bye.
Bye. Bye. We'll be right back.